and I mentioned this on the trip this summer as we're traveling around. I'm going to ask you to submit a list of up to five, doesn't have to be, projects not in your district that you think are important and we should consider in the final bill. So I'd like the input from the committee as to what projects they would like to see done.
What is the one on the bullet point?
Not in my district. You know, that is in my district. So if you want to recommend something, you could.
Yeah.
Yes, Representative Carlson.
Your definition of that, I've had the interest in the DeCola Ponds. They are physically in Golden Valley, so not in my district, but the flooding impacts on New Hope, Crystal, and Golden Valley. So by your definition of the five, I'm just...
I'm not going to hold you, too rigidly to this. What I'm getting at is
we're on the DNR list, so
yeah,
we're halfway there.
The only reason I'm saying is not in your district is because I assume that everyone would put down the projects just in their districts if I didn't suggest that they take a little wider vision. Not to say that your projects won't be considered, especially as I said, you can request hearings for them if you wish. All right. Any other questions? Moving right along. Today, we are going to have an overview of our water infrastructure projects. Our first up will be the director of the Public Facilities Authority, Mr. Jeff Freeman. Take the stand, please, and begin. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Freeman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. We are the state agency that finances primarily wastewater and drinking water infrastructure projects for our cities, big and small, all around the state. You should have our copy of our packet in your packet, including all of our green and blue spreadsheets and the detailed list of projects. And there's a few extras that are at the table here. So there's a lot of information here. I will go through pretty quickly. I know time is limited, but please feel free to stop me if there's any questions. The governor's bonding request for the PFA water infrastructure programs is $167 million. That breaks down to three major programs. First is the state match for our revolving loan funds, $25 million. These are our low-interest loans. They're supported by annual federal capitalization grants, and the state is required to provide a 20% match. We leverage those funds with PFA revenue bond proceeds, and then all of the repayments revolve back to make new loans. So it provides a permanent source of low-cost capital for cities to build these projects in perpetuity. These are the state's largest programs. The Clean Water Program started in 1990. To date, we've made a total of $3.8 billion in loans. Very strong leveraging with this program. Every $1 of state matching funds to date has supported $16 in construction and more than $3 in interest savings because the loans are made at below market interest rates. Last year, our average interest rate was about 1.1%. The requested funds will provide that required state match, the federal dollars, and also help build the loan capacity. Currently, the funds revolve at a level of about $94 million a year on the clean water side. $40 million on the drinking water side. That's an average lending capacity, as we call it. But the loan requests, you can see, were more than three times that amount. The second program is the WIF, the Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program, $80 million. These are supplemental grants that are based on affordability criteria for high-cost projects. The WIF grants are packaged with our low-interest loans, or can also be used to match funds with our federal partner, USDA Rural Development. The affordability criteria really looks at what's the total cost of the system per household in the city compared to the median household income of the city. That formula is written into statute, and it sets a 1.4% level for the wastewater side, 1.2% of median household income for drinking water. So when a city's O&M costs, debt service costs, all of that put together divided by the number of users, when it exceeds that amount, they're potentially eligible for the WIF grants. Finally, the Point Source Implementation Grant Program, the third program on the list, $62 million is the governor's request. These are grants that help cities upgrade treatment facilities to reduce the discharge of specific pollutants in order to meet more stringent treatment requirements that are determined by the Pollution Control Agency based on the needs of the specific receiving waters. Grants are for 80% of the eligible cost, which is the cost to provide that additional level of treatment, $7 million maximum. We take applications once a year for that program in July. And as with all of our programs, we don't fund the project until it's been approved and certified by the Pollution Control Agency and basically ready to start construction. And that's mentioned in the note down at the bottom of the first page, including also the fact that all of these programs follow the Pollution Control Agency's project priority list, or for drinking water, the Health Department's project priority list. They have established in their rules ranking criteria that are based on the age and condition of the city's infrastructure, as well as water quality and public health criteria. On the back second page, just a quick little overview of the PFA. As I said, we administer programs to finance all of these water infrastructure projects for cities throughout the state. We do it in conjunction with the Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department. Our partner agencies do the set the project priorities based on their rule criteria. They do the technical and environmental reviews, and they certify the projects to us when they're ready. My staff, PFA staff, conduct credit reviews, set the loan terms and conditions, service the loans, do the overall fund management of the assets in the revolving funds. The eligible projects for these programs are all types of basic municipal water infrastructure: wastewater treatment plants, drinking water treatment plants, sewer collection systems, water main distribution systems, wells, water towers, all of that. The basic funding framework is that the low-interest loans are available to cities throughout the state, and then there are targeted grants that are, as I said, based on either affordability criteria, which is the WIF program, or the more stringent treatment requirements. PFA has authority to sell up to $2 billion in tax-exempt revenue bonds to leverage the dollars in the revolving loan funds. Our PFA revenue bonds are AAA rated by all three rating agencies. There's no no state backing to PFA bonds. They're totally supported by loan repayments and investment earnings. We also received no general fund appropriations for administration of our programs. All the admin funds for PFA come from financing fees on the loans. PFA has we're very small, 10 staff, small staff, lots of money. We also provide funds to Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department for staff at their agencies that do the technical reviews. The bottom of the first page kind of walks through the basic application process, which is the first step. Cities submit requests to get on the project priority list. Those lists are essentially five-year lists of projects ranked in order based on the criteria that I mentioned before. So it's projects that cities are seeking funding for construction over a five-year period. And so they're in all different stages of readiness. Some of the projects on the priority list are brand new and just in the early planning stages. Others are well down the road and ready to start construction this spring. Once a city has done the preliminary work and plans to have a project ready for construction in the coming year, then they submit a request to PFA to be put on what's called our intended use plan, which is the list of projects eligible to apply for loans each year. We also use then the application, the loan application, to determine if a project's eligible for the WIF grant program. There's a separate application for that point source grant program. We don't award funding, as I mentioned, until projects are certified and ready to start construction. If a project is receives the, or is approved and certified by Pollution Control Agency or the Health Department by the end of one fiscal year, then now they're ready to go, and that I'll show you how that works. But then they have essentially we reserve funds at that point, and they have some time to go through the bidding process so that they can do that in a way that's most cost effective for getting good bids. So then there's the green lists are the waste or the clean water project priority list. Most of these projects are wastewater projects. There are some stormwater treatment projects as well. Projects you can see are ranked column 2, 1 through I think 300 and something based on the priority system in PCA rules. You can see a short project description that in many cases kind of gets cut off because there's a lot to squeeze onto one spreadsheet. Project costs, and then column 5 is the loans or the projects that are eligible for on the intended use plan and eligible for loans this year. There's a little bit of the federal money that we receive that we can provide as grant, but they don't like to call it grant, so that's the term CWRF, Principal Forgiveness Grant, in column 7. We can slice off a little of the federal dollars that follow the same WIF affordability criteria as the state WIF program. Columns 8, 9, and 10 are related to the WIF program. They'll show the projects that currently have funds awarded or reserved. This is a list that is prepared each year, so you'll see this was approved by PCA in July. It governs fiscal year 18. So you'll see some projects that have, a little hard to see, but a shaded line all the way across. Those projects have now been funded and are under construction. Others where just the cell is shaded means we've reserved the money and they're in the process now of completing the application process so we can award that project. So there's WIF funds that have been awarded or reserved basically from last year's bonding appropriation. And then there's columns 9 and 10, estimated needs for width going forward. Column 11, point source implementation grants. Those are projects that have applied. They applied last July, working on now completing the plan and spec design work. Some of them have funds awarded. Others are going to be waiting for additional appropriations. There's a small community program that deals with very small and sewered communities, and then columns 14, 15 are USDA Rural Development Partners, as well as some other funding partners. So after the green sheets, you'll come to the first white sheet is a breakout of the WIF program. As I mentioned, we follow the project priority list, but we also focus on readiness to proceed, which projects are ready to go. We don't want to have money appropriated and then have to be waiting for it. We want to put it into projects that are ready for construction as quickly as possible. So you'll see on this list, and these dollars, this is the same as the green list. It's just pulling out the projects that have been identified as potentially WIF eligible. The first group there is called FY 2017 carryover projects. These were all approved and certified by the Pollution Control Agency at the end of last fiscal year, June 30th of 2017. Many of them we've already awarded. All of them have funds reserved and are working towards getting construction started this year. The next group says potential WIF needs, FY 2018 IUP, and RD projects. So these are the projects that are on that intended use plan. The loan money is basically available for them now, and they are working through the process. These estimated WIF grant needs are what, based on the preliminary information that we've received from the projects, it appears they would be eligible for on the WIF grant program. And then there's the column for the rural development projects. Rural development focuses on the small rural communities, generally under 1,000 population. And as I said, we can use the WIF grants to match funds. They do loans and grants for the small rural communities, similar to PFA programs. And by matching some of the state money with them, it allows them to fund more projects, and they're actually able to, in most years, use up all of their federal allocation and go back to their federal pot of money and get some additional money that some other states maybe weren't able to use. So the WIF partnership with rural development has been very effective for and works well for both of us. You'll see the cumulative total column and a dotted line about a little more than halfway down the page under the city of Eagle Bend. As we recall, and as noted at the top right corner, there was $40 million that was appropriated in last year's bonding bill for the WIF program. That dotted line represents basically the last project that could be fully funded if all of these come in at the current estimated amounts, we would get that far down the list. Now we'll know by the end of this spring whether these have actually made it or not, we expect we'll be able to fund that far down the list. The projects below the dotted line need additional appropriations.
So, Mr. Freeman, am I to assume then if Eagle Bend is funded this year that Casson would be number one next year?
The next one past Eagle Bend is Western Lakes Superior Sanitary District has a large project. That one is sort of kind of partially funded right now. But to be the first to be in that position for next year, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, they have to have the project ready to go. They have to get the PCA approval and certification or the rural development approval. Now, in the case of Casson, at this point, you'll see it's on the list, meaning it's on that intended use plan. Right now, we're not showing any WIF need for Casson. Casson will, you'll see Casson again when we come to the PSIG list. At this point, they don't seem to trigger the WIF grant need. So this is, you'll see a number of cities on this list that right now they don't have an identified WIF need. That could change as numbers are finalized.
Like Eden Valley, for example, could have a bigger WIF need.
Yes.
Especially since it's in my district.
If Eden Valley can get plans and specs submitted to the Pollution Control Agency and get those approved and certified by June 30th, they'll move next year when we do this list. They'll be up in that carryover list. Now, we still will follow the priority order of that group, but them a leg up.
That's what I appreciate about how you do things. The priority ranking is, you know, pretty much the way things are. And I'll just ask you now, like, you had $167 million on the green sheet. How far down would you be able to go, do you know?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's why I've got these separate lists, because the green sheet is only priority order, but it doesn't bring in the factor of which projects are actually ready to go. As I said, the green sheet is like five-year list of projects. So the white sheet for the wastewater WIF program gives you a better sense of how far down can we go right now, which cities are below that dotted line and will need additional money appropriated for the WIF program. The page after the WIF.
I think Representative Uglum has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Freeman, now you mentioned that these projects are ready. You said PCA approvals and things like that. Does that also include architectural engineering drawings and things? So that's all essentially shovel ready.
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, yes.
Mr. Freeman.
That's the main part of PCA's review, is the engineering design plans and specifications.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglum.
So do those engineering costs and everything else, are those borne by the cities, or is that also do your grants help them with that?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum. The cities up front the money, and once the project starts construction and we award the funds, we reimburse them for those prior incurred engineering and other costs.
Representative Uglum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then what the numbers we're seeing here are complete numbers, complete engineering, complete finished project estimate numbers.
Correct. Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, total project costs are the
perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Runbeck, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. You have a column here, Mr. Freeman, called Small Cities, and I remember a few years back there were cities that got in over their heads on some of these water projects. And I'm just curious, I mean, they really, you know, the project size was so large. Is that still the case, that there might be some of these cities that aren't able in the end to afford to pay for them?
Mr. Freeman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, I recall what you're talking about. There were some very small communities that there was sort of a perfect storm of problems with technology that maybe wasn't the best, construction methods that maybe weren't the best, engineering design that. A lot of those were related to what were some specific kinds of wetland treatment systems and things that in a perfect world they would do a fine job, but they were a lot for a small community to deal with. And so there was money appropriated. A lot of those were or I don't want to blame. It was a combination with our partners at USDA Rural Development, and there was some state money appropriated that went back to make some corrections to the treatment process or the some of the controls and some of the things. So I think all of those now have been corrected. It's still difficult for a small community to operate some of these systems. There are organizations like Minnesota Rural Water Association that help cities with the operational part of it, and it is so they do a great job with that. But you're correct; it's for some small communities, it is tough.
Well, Mr. Freeman, so just
Representative Rundeck.
So I and Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. So the design of these projects, then, is that are we able to control at that level that we're not going to be over-designing for those situations?
Yes, Mr. No? Chair, Representative Rundbeck, I think that we have all learned a lot from that period of time where, and I know the Pollution Control Agency actually did a study of some of these small systems and what went wrong, and there was actually an interagency group that met for over a year, and a big part of the discussion was figuring out where did things go wrong with those projects. This is back in about 2005, 6, 7, 8, that time frame. A lot of work has been done to look at those situations really closely and make sure we don't have those kind of problems again.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Freeman, I kind of wondered what was the situation, so thanks.
Representative Hausman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions of a general nature. Did you want him to finish his presentation before we ask, or how?
Representative Hausman, I think we'll let him finish and then come back to you first. Mr. Freeman?
After the green sheet, as I said, there's the one page of the WIF breakdown, and then there's the next sheet. Following that is the Point Source Implementation Grant Program. The third program on the front sheet, the governor recommends $62 million. These, again, are the projects that have to essentially do some kind of treatment upgrade to meet a more stringent treatment requirement to protect the receiving waters and the downstream waters. Again, it's broken into FY17 carryover projects are those that were certified by the end of last fiscal year, and you can see that almost all of those now are shaded, and we funded those. And then there are the FY18, the new applications. In the top right corner is a breakdown of the funding that's been appropriated to date. Including $33.7 million from last year's bonding bill, and almost $16 million that also was appropriated from the Clean Water Legacy Fund last year, which is divided into FY18 part and an FY19. So those funds have allowed us to fund all of the projects in that carryover list, with one still to come. And then start down the new list. We funded Detroit Lakes, a very large project there, just a couple of months ago. City of Gilbert is just ranked just above that, and I know they're working, and those are in the fundable range. Then there's a dotted line, and then projects below that, there's a smaller dotted line. That's the starting in FY19, we get that additional $10.5 million from that was appropriated last year for Clean Water Legacy in FY19. So we can drop down and hopefully pick up those additional projects. The other projects below that dotted line and onto the second page, again, we'll need additional appropriations for those projects. I know that many of them have submitted plans and specifications, the engineering work to the PCA, or are in the process of doing so, and are moving forward to try to get approved and certified by June 30th. I also know that I also expect that some of these will not, and they're not quite that far along. They got the application in, but they're not quite that far along. We will know better in the next month and a half or so, which of these are really going to be ready to go this year. But right now, they're all eligible, and this is the priority order of those projects. Following that, there is an alphabetical list. If you're trying to find a particular project in the green sheets, it's kind of hard. So the alphabetical list gives you the rank number to look for when you switch over to the green sheets. And, of course, I'm always welcome or always happy to help anytime if you call or stop me and help talk about a specific project and where they might be in the process. Then there's the blue sheets, which are the drinking water list, ranked by the Department of Health based on age and condition and public health criteria. Treatment plants are at the top for the most part, and then there's a variety of water main replacement projects, new wells, water towers, a variety of things. A similar process. You can see the intended use plan requested loans. Those are the projects that did apply to get on the loan list this year, the first step that when they have a project that they're planning to have ready for construction, the small amount of principal forgiveness grants, and then the WIF grants. This is the first year the WIF program has applied to drinking water projects. That was a change that was made last session. I appreciate that very much because there were a lot of drinking water projects that really needed that additional state grant funds. And then you can see the other funders as well. After the blue list, the first white sheet provides the breakout of the drinking water WIF program, the affordability-based grants, and who is in line for those. Last year's bonding bill appropriated $15 million for the drinking water WIF. The carryover list, as you see, there's a dotted line under the city of Glendon, which is basically the end of the carryover list. So the money that was appropriated is all currently in line and reserved for those projects that were approved at the end of last fiscal year. We funded many of them. You can see the shaded line that goes all the way across, and others are in the process of getting ready for construction start this spring. Then below that, all of those potential 2018 WIF needs, all of those projects will need additional WIF funds. This is, again, the 18 IUP list, so many of them show that a WIF need based on preliminary numbers. Some of them do not at this point, but that could change. And so that is the drinking water list. There's also an alphabetical list for that, the drinking water section as well. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm done and happy to answer any other questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Freeman. And I believe Representative Hausman, you're first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of follow-ups to responses you gave earlier. When someone said, what if a local government can't, or how do they pay for that original amount of money? And you said, well, they upfront it, and then you reimburse. I thought we couldn't reimburse with general obligation bonding.
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, that is one of the many benefits of the you funding programs instead of individual projects.
Oh.
And particularly with our revolving loan fund, it does include state GO bonds that come in as match, but we also have federal dollars that do not have any restriction on reimbursement. We have our own bond proceeds that do have a restriction, but then there's also essentially the recycled dollars that do not. So there's a mix of dollars in the revolving fund, and it gives us flexibility to do that kind of thing, where if you were funding an individual project, you would not be able to.
And then, Mr. Chair, if I could, just sort of a follow-up to Representative Runbeck's line of questioning. I'm assuming as Greater Minnesota evolves that there are towns with declining populations and the demographics are such that, you know, at a certain point you ask the question of how much do you spend on a wastewater project. Would you say, I mean, is that part of your judgment? I mean, like, can they afford their part of the heavy lifting?
Mr. Freeman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, there certainly are some where it makes you stop and think.
And so,
make sure the city understands, because all of these, nobody gets 100% grant, and then they have the operational O&M costs, which by themselves in some small cities can be $40, $50 a month just to operate a system because they have such a small base to work from. We are very careful to make sure the city understands that for the even if they're getting a full 80% grant, there's debt service to pay back on the loan. And that's our big thing. We're making sure they have the user charges in place to generate the revenue, to operate their system, to pay back the debt. We show them very clearly what does that mean on a per-household basis, what are you going to have to raise rates to. Whether or not that's affordable is kind of, we're not the ones to say what's affordable. We try to make sure the city understands, and then it's in their hands to, if they decide that they are willing to raise the rates and they need to do the project, then we'll do it. And in most cases, by working with rural development, in some cases working with other funders, there's the DEED Small Cities Program, we'll try to cobble together as much funds as we can to make the project affordable. I don't have any that are have officially simply said we can't do anything, but there are a number that are in a real challenging spot. They absolutely need the WIF money, and you know, we're working with them to kind of work through the process and figure it out. Part of it is also just making sure that the consulting engineer that's working with them, that they're looking as hard as possible at what's the most cost-effective alternative, that they're not overbuilding anything. There's no simple answers to that, but there's a lot of pieces that we try to make sure come together to make that at least a feasible project.
Mr. Chair, that is what I wondered. You used the term cost-effective alternative, that, you know, when every business in the town has closed, when there's no longer a doctor's office or a grocery store or anything like that, you sort of see the handwriting on the wall. So are there, for lack of a better term, low-tech alternatives that can be part of the conversation then?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, there, I mean, we have a number of unsewered communities in the state, and I kind of skipped over it quickly, but there is a small community program. It's on the green sheets that's specifically designed to help small unsewered communities fix the failing septic systems, do the site evaluations and the soil borings, and to find those kind of low-tech cluster mounds and things that are less capital-intensive than a more full-blown municipal-type system would be. And so that program has helped a number of small unsewered communities do exactly that. Once the city has a municipal system, it's hard to go back. And so I don't think I don't think there's any real clear answers right now on is it possible to have a system and then sort of go back to septic tanks again. Typically the lots and the soils and everything make that real challenging.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm not on the Legislative Water Commission. I don't know whether you are or anyone, but my understanding is that they had a discussion something like this, and out of that discussion that there were some recommendations that they were shaping, but I haven't seen that.
Mr. Freeman?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, and they had a meeting on Monday night and had a good discussion on a number of issues, including that one. They're going to be putting together, I think, their final recommendations. I think it's fair to say there aren't necessarily specific answers to that, but there was an agreement that there needs to continue that discussion of how to deal with those challenges.
Yeah, Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Freeman, how many of these projects, and it's a big, big, long list and everything else, are being driven by the changes in standards that the Pollution Control Agency has put in place for phosphorus and nitrates and things like that? How many of these projects? Do you have any idea?
Well,
Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, that is, as far as projects that we actually know of right now, that is the Point Source Implementation Grant Program. So there's that breakout list, and those are the ones that have applied right now. And they're expensive. There's no doubt about that. But they're also needed to protect the state's waters, and that's PCA's job. My job is to figure out how to get them funded. When you look at the big picture, the Pollution Control Agency does their wind survey, a 20-year look into the future. What are the wastewater needs in the state? $4.5 billion or something like that over 20 years. The slice of the pie that's for the new standards, the advanced treatment, is quite small compared to other things. It's, as I recall, it's about 10%, like 9%, something like that. I'm sorry, I don't have that right now. But the vast majority of those needs are replacing the old pipes in the ground, the 40-year-old treatment plants. Those are by far the biggest part of the overall wastewater needs.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on that, you say, you know, replacement, rebuilding water treatment plants, sewage treatment plants, things like this. How important is the regulatory certainty issue that we've been kicking around here the last couple of sessions? In other words, what I mean is, so we fund a municipality, for instance, like Morris or whoever, and they build a plant, and then the standards change in the next few years. And there is a bill that says that regulatory certainty would be for 16 years after you build your plant, you're essentially grandfathered in. How important is that, in your opinion, and to your agency?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, I think it's quite important. These are really big investments by cities, and they're very big investments, and I think cities can use all the predictability that they can get. We talk a lot with cities about asset management, making sure they, you know, maximize the useful life of what they have and plan for those future needs, have a capital improvement plan so they can know what's coming and set rates accordingly and adjust for it. The more predictable those future needs are, the better. So Yeah, I mean, we can run the program either way, but for the cities, I think it's quite important.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One final follow-up. Yeah. Well, I think so, too, and there is a bill making its way through the system here in the House and the Senate right now on that. We did actually hear it in Environment this morning. And there's certainly, to me, absolutely no sense in turning around and building a new treatment plant and then a couple years later someone come along and saying, sorry, you're out of compliance, do it again. So I'm glad to hear you say that, and I think most people share that idea. So hopefully when we're looking at this in the future, the list eventually gets a little shorter. Thank you.
Representative Dittmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Freeman. There's a project that I see in Washington County and Lake Elmo, and it deals with the contamination of a well. Now, does that have anything to do with the 3M issue, or do you recall that or not?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dittmer, I offhand do not know for sure. I can check into that and see if that is related at all. I'm not sure.
What would Mr. Chair?
Representative Dittmer.
What would happen, let's say, assume in that area they settled a lawsuit with 3M, and all of a sudden an area gets a flood of money in. What does that do with a project like this?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dittmer, and with that specific pot of money, I really don't have any idea how that's going to work. But in general, if a city has some other source of money, we're happy to work with them on, making, if they're eligible, they're on the list, we can certainly make a low-interest loan for the balance of the funding and work that into the overall funding package. That would be an easy one to work with if they come with their own money like that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Along those lines, Mr. Freeman, that the money from the lawsuit with 3M, I've heard that it's going to be devoted to projects mainly in the Southeast Metro. Is that your understanding as well, or do you have any idea how that money will be used?
Mr. Chair, only what I read in the newspaper. I
that's where I got it, too.
I don't have any inside information on that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Freeman, I've got a couple of questions. You referenced that sometimes the cost to the homeowner would be $40 to $50 per month. Sometimes I've heard even higher numbers. How does the city typically handle that for low-income people or senior citizens that might be on a fixed income? I'm asking the affordability. How would a typical city address that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, state law as in Minnesota, as most states, essentially suggests that costs should be proportional to use, which essentially says any household that uses X amount of water should pay the same rate. I'm not aware, I do not believe that there's anything in state statutes that sort of authorize a city to have different rate structures based on poverty factors or things like that. I know that is something that has begun to be looked at in a few cities around the country. It would have to be really done at the city level in setting the rates, as you suggest. But I'm not aware of anything right now that specifically authorizes that in Minnesota state law.
No, I was picking up on the fact when you mentioned the 40 to 50, and I know sometimes it's higher. And I remember a few years ago when we were touring the state, I remember one community in particular, a very small community, and the look of the community, if you will. I would have guessed that most of the people were, in all likelihood, fairly low income. I don't know that to be a fact, but that would be kind of the appearance. And so I was wondering just how that would be handled in that situation. Could I go to another question then, Mr. Chairman?
Representative
Mr. Freeman, you mentioned appropriation bonds and the revolving loan fund. Was that where the appropriation bonds would be used, the revolving loan fund?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, what I referred to, not appropriation bonds, but revenue bonds.
Revenue bonds
that are backed just by the loan repayments themselves. So that's what my agency does. It allows us to sort of take that federal and state money and all those prior loans and leverage those funds to generate additional loan dollars.
So, Mr. Chairman, I misspoke when I said appropriate. You did say revenue funds, when I think about it. But you mentioned that they were low interest, if I recall, or lower interest. I was curious as to what kind of an interest rate you'd get with a revenue bond then.
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson.
I know that probably varies, but.
The bonds that we sell are AAA rated, which allows them to get the best interest rate in the market at the time. But then we're able to actually make loans at a lower rate than our cost of money because of the federal and the federal capitalization grants and the state match. That equity and the revolving funds allows us to basically subsidize the interest rates below our cost of money.
Mr. Chairman, what is the cost of that money initially?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, so I don't know. Last time we sold bonds was a year ago, so I'm not sure where it's at right now, 3-something, I suppose. But the loans we make, as I said earlier, 2017 average interest rate was about 1.1%.
That would be the actual, but then the difference would be which went into the market for, which you're saying, I'm just ballparking now, roughly 3%, and you're able to provide them with a 1.1% by subsidizing.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, our interest rate structure sets, there's a base interest rate discount that's up 1.5% below the AAA market. And in smaller communities, there's some additional discounts. Smaller communities can potentially get additional discounts.
Even below the, Mr. Chairman, the 1.1 then, for some, and under certain circumstances.
Mr. Chair, the 1% is our minimum. So it's market rates have been so low for quite some time that the 1% minimum, most of our loans have been pretty close to that. Now, the market's starting to tick up, and our rates will a little bit too, but they're still always significantly below the market.
Mr. Chairman, if you could, I'm kind of interested in this revolving loan fund then. Could you give us just a little bit more information on just how that works with the revolving loan fund?
Mr. Chairman Carlson,
we do need to move along.
Each year we do get a federal capitalization grant, both the clean water and the drinking water, two separate grants, two separate funds. And then there's a require then that's ranged. It's gone up and down over the years, $45 million or so between the two funds. And then the state provides a 20% match. Those funds are, we lend those out right away. The state dollars that we get from state geo bonds, we do lend out in compliance with all of the state requirements on state geo bond proceeds. But then we also are able to meet the demand and to keep the kind of level out the program. We're able to sell our revenue bonds, which are then based on the repayment stream, all the prior loans, and we have to produce a lot of materials in our bond resolutions to show that we've got the revenues to pay back those bonds. It's coming from all those prior loans.
And I got the hint, Mr. Chairman. So I've got a couple more questions. So
that wasn't meant for you, Representative Carlson, but since you're willing to move on, we will.
I got the hand, yeah. But no, I got enough for now, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Sock.
Oh, thank you.
See? Very good, Representative Sock. Thank you. Mr. Freeman, I think we may be done with you, at least in this circumstance.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just.
Oh, thanks.
I believe that Ms. Gatte is here from MPCA. Could we have her come down and answer the question? Identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Greta Gauthier, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I can try to answer your questions about the 3M settlement, and I can tell you broadly what the settlement is about or where it's going to be focused.
Briefly and broadly would be good. Yep. Thank you.
So the state of Minnesota settled with the 3M company last Monday and Tuesday, excuse me. It was an $850 million settlement. It was a natural resources damages suit. The priority one for spending the money is to ensure long-term and sustainable drinking water for the communities that are impacted by PFC contamination from four disposal sites that 3M used back in the 40s and 50s. Those communities right now are Afton, Cottage Grove, Lake Elmo, Newport, Oakdale, St. Paul Park, Woodbury, and the townships of Gray Cloud Island and West Lakeland. So we are working fast but thoroughly to set up a process to start helping those communities decide what they want to do for the long term in terms of wastewater treatment. Excuse me, in terms of drinking water.
Drinking water.
Yeah, sorry. Late.
Thank you for that. And Representative Frankie, did you have anything to add on that, since it does impact your area?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, it's a tragic situation all the way around. The agencies have been great to us so far. They have been very open and forthcoming and are being wonderful about communication, and I did just forward a copy of the actual settlement language, I believe, to Gavin, so anybody, maybe we can just get that sent out to everybody so that you have the actual settlement language to look at to see how the everything's going to break out. But so that language is there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Greta, also the language also states or other affected cities, correct? So that if the plume does move and change, that the other cities would also be able. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Juergens, yes. It says in the future, if the plume moves in a way that impacts drinking water for any of those other communities not yet impacted, then they also would fall under and be able to benefit from this settlement.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Representative Frankie, Representative Juergens, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's important to note also that this was a $5 billion lawsuit that 3M settled for $850 million. And we neglected to mention the fact that the Department of Health study did show that there was no adverse effects, as far as they could see, in terms of increased rates of cancer or lowered birth weight rates or anything like that. And that's the reason for the much lower settlement and I think the main reason for the settlement from $5 billion to $850 million. So, and that was well covered in the press. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll now have a discussion on local water infrastructure issues with the cities of Pipestone and Little Falls. John Rademacher, Little Falls City Administrator, and Myron Coates. I don't know. You'll pronounce these words for me, and then I'll know how to say them. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good chair.
Please identify yourselves and then present to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, committee. I am John Rademacher. I'm the City Administrator in Little Falls.
and I'm here to talk to you about a project that we've identified, and we're on the Point Source Implementation Grant. We've been in for the application process. Our treatment facility was built originally in 1954, underwent a major renovation to what it is today in 1985, with an additional renovation in 2002. So we're still into existing debt service from the 2002 upgrades. Starting in 2015, we were analyzing our rates to make additional plant upgrades to that facility, starting about 2022 when the old debt would taper off, and we were going to raise our rates accordingly. At that time, we raised our rates almost 200%, and in the plan to have the existing debt paid off as well as have the adequate funding to support the new rehab to the treatment facility, and without having additional major rate increases after that. Since then, we've had our new discharge permit from MPCA. With that came a new phosphorus limit, and with a feasibility study to meet the new phosphorus limit, we've determined that our plant upgrades are now $17 million, and $11 million of that plant upgrade is strictly to meet the new phosphorus limits. So we are eligible for the max of the PSIG grant at the $7 million level. If we weren't able to receive the funding for the full $7 million, our rates would, again, nearly double or nearly triple. At this point, we are looking at just a modest increase of 30% to our base charges to cover that $10 million charge that we would be responsible for through the PFA financing.
And Mr. Rademacher, okay, so you're paying $10 million more for the phosphorus reduction?
Yeah, $11 million more.
And how much is that going to reduce the phosphorus?
Mr. Chair, that would reduce it from 1.6 to 0.8 milligrams per liter, I believe, is the measurement that they use. So it would cut it in half.
Okay. Any questions of Mr. Rademacher?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No. My name is Myron Coots. Oh, excuse me. Go ahead.
Does it run back?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if the gentleman that just spoke, could you put that into monthly dollars of the water bill?
Sure, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rademacher.
Currently, our rates are at $15 per month. If we were to support the full cost of the improvements, it would be at $40 a month. With the grant funds, we would be at $20 a month.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck.
Chairman Udall, thank you very much for allowing me to come here today and fellow committee members. My name is Myron Coots, K-O-E-T-S, from Pipestone. And if I say Minnesota, it's because we're so close to South Dakota, sometimes I forget exactly where I'm at.
I noticed your accent.
Anyway, the city of Pipestone was actually funded last year, and we're in the process of building a $15 million lime-based water treatment facility to address three major issues in our drinking water sources. The first two problems are chloride and the suspended solids, and that was needed to be addressed because of the MPCA wastewater permit and the standards that they had established, which was set to expire in the year 2020. So we were, our backs were cut against the wall to get a project up and going. We have very hard water to the point where the citizens use their soft water softeners to an excessive amount. Because of that, when you flush out a soft water softener, you flush salt back into your wastewater system, and our chloride levels of our wastewater exceed the allowable limits for discharge. Suspended solids was caused by two of our five wells in the city of Pipestone that are approaching 100 years old. And because of that, they would need extensive rework to even be able to continue to use them. Part of the grant process, we are in the process of drilling two new wells. Gross alpha, or radiation, is also a problem in Pipestone because we are drilling into a large Sioux quartzite for a rock formation. And one of the byproducts that you get out of that rock formation is gross alpha or radiation. And so that was also really a problem for us, that we had to mix water out of a couple different wells with the water coming out of that rock formation to get our allowable limits within the standards. It would be prohibitively expensive for the wastewater facility to try to, you know, filter out the chloride, essentially a desalinization process and the suspended solids. Our new water treatment plant will soften the water to a point where the water softeners will not need to recharge that often. And because of that waste, the salt getting into the wastewater, we should be able to get our chloride levels within the allowable limits. The gross alpha will be mitigated in the lime softening process and the suspended solids with the two new wells and also with the water treatment facility will help eliminate that. Without getting some sort of assistance to offset the cost of this project, it would have been devastating to our community. We would have had to increase our, and I'll go by meter charge, more than fourfold per household to actually try to afford this. We were at $25 per meter charge or access fee, and we would have been at over $100 per access fee if we hadn't gotten any assistance. The city of Pipestone did receive a $7 million point source grant and an $8 million loan from the Public Finance Authority. And I would like to personally, on behalf of the citizens of Pipestone, thank you for funding that through the bonding bill last year. The PFA programs are essential in getting the projects done, even with the assistance, our water rates.
Mr. Kutz, what are you paying then?
What are we paying? We got a $7 million grant and $8 million loan.
Okay. I think you said the rate was 25 and it would have been over 100. What is it now?
Oh, what is it now? We did raise it to 37. And that's the point that we're going to have to raise that some more in the future to cash flow this. And I can tell you that a gentleman asked me earlier, how is that going? Our rates, new rates just went out. I can tell you that a lot of my constituents are questioning my genetic background. And our utilities clerk is receiving somewhere between 15 and 20 calls a day questioning why, even with all the publicity that we had given, why had it gone up so high. Pipestone is a population of about 4,300 people in southwest Minnesota. We're primarily an agricultural community which supports corn, soybeans, dairy, hog, and the beef industry. So we're typical rural town. One of the unique things about Pipestone is where we derived our name, which is a soft soup quartzite rock that they had made peace pipes out of. And we're also the home of the only national monument in Minnesota. So with that, there's about 1,890 residential and commercial meters, water meters in our community. If we were going to take the cost of that $15 million cost and amortize that over the meters, that would come out to about $8,000 of debt load per meter. Pipestone is, we feel that we're very financially a responsible city. We strive to take care of our infrastructure. However, our taxing capacity is very limited. Typically, a 1% levy increase only yields $15,000. Also, since this is, we're talking about a revenue fund or an enterprise fund at this point, we just do not have the numbers of water meters to charge to really cash flow a full-fledged project. Cities in greater Minnesota do not enjoy these economies of scales as metro communities do, such as the high volume of water usage, water meters. Given demands to maintain and improve infrastructure, ability to set aside reserves fund for future high-dollar projects is very limited. This was not a project that we could have saved to build, primarily because of the drop-dead date of our wastewater permit. And so we were, our back was against the wall. We had to get assistance. If we could have waited 10 years for the project, just a quick figuring, it would take a $66 a month surcharge per meter in addition to what the population is paying right now to cash flow it. If we were to borrow that money, and you look at that, you were talking about borrowing money earlier, a couple of you, but I just took a 2.5% interest rate. Just that alone, based in Pipestone, or 1,890 meters, it would take $16.50 a month surcharge just to pay the interest. Moreover, the wastewater are not our only infrastructure needs in our community.
So, Mr. Coates,
Coot.
Conclude. I will, right now.
No, no, I didn't, I didn't say conclude, Coots. I just said Mr. Coots.
Yes.
What is the total amount then that, without any aid, without any loans or grants, what would your people be paying?
What would they be paying? They would be paying They would be paying roughly $115 per meter plus usage.
Plus usage, yes.
And when we base that on a the first 10,000 gallons, everybody is the same after 10,000 gallons.
And this is why we bond.
Yes. Without that, the community of Pipestone would have been in deep doo-doo. So even with the assistance, we're still going to have to increase our water rates. But in conclusion, it's kind of interesting. 3 weeks ago, long before I was even thinking about coming up here to talk to all of you, is that I picked up a book, and it's called, the title of that book is 13 Ways to Kill a Community. And it's kind of a satirical look at, if you really want to kill your community, here's what you can do. The first and most important and first chapter of that book was on water. Sure. If you don't have enough water and you don't have quality water, your community is destined to die. City of Pipestone owes safe drinking water to our citizens, at least that's what our council feels, and also on our discharge size, clean water to the state of Minnesota. We are grateful for the PFA grant and loans that are allowing us to move forward on this project. We encourage the Capital Investment Committee to fully fund these PFA programs to assist other cities in greater Minnesota with addressing these important water issues. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Song.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Tell me either population or number of cities, you can choose which metric you want to use, in your immediate area that have essentially the same geology that you're struggling with.
I belong to the, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I do belong to the Southwest Regional Development Commission, which covers nine counties. Basically, all nine counties are in the same boat.
Anything else? Thank you, gentlemen. And now, our final item on the agenda is an overview of the local road and bridge fund by the Department of Transportation. Mr. Mitch Rasmussen, MnDOT Assistant Commissioner of State Aid. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. As you mentioned, my name is Mitch Rasmussen. I'm Assistant Commissioner for the State Aid Division of MnDOT, and I'm here to give an overview of the Local Road Improvement Program and the Local Bridge Replacement Program. Before I get into those programs, I want to give just a few details about some of the quick background on the local agency systems.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to interrupt. Can he use the microphone?
Mr. Rasmussen, please speak a little more directly. It moves.
Sure. My apologies, Mr. Chair and Representative. So a little bit of background on the systems in Minnesota, the local systems. We have 87 counties. You can see some of the statistics there. I won't take a lot of time in reading them. Some of the more significant ones are the 8,000 bridges on the local system, state aid cities, 3,000 miles on the MSA system, 26,000 miles on the local system. That also includes cities under 5,000, as well as the bridge totals that include those cities. And then on our township system, we have over 55,000 miles and over 6,000 bridges. There's a lot of numbers here. Maybe the most important numbers are 92% of the roadway miles are on the local road system, and 80% of the bridges are also on the local system. So a significant number of infrastructure, or amount of infrastructure on the local system. So now I'll get into the local road improvement program a little bit. With the growing transportation needs for improvements on the local road system, the local road improvement program was created in 2002. Project solicitation occurs through our office whenever the legislature appropriates money into the program. Our program focuses on routes of regional significance and safety, and the selection process includes an advisory committee made up of local stakeholders. There's one county engineer on that committee, one city engineer from cities of over 5,000, one county commissioner, one elected city official from cities over 5,000, and one elected city official from cities under 5,000. The committee is used to review the projects and make recommendations. This fund can only be used for construction, so the right-of-way, engineering, other costs associated with delivering these programs are borne by the local agencies. Although some of the earmarked projects that come through have specific language to make those items eligible. And our office, the Office of State Aid in MnDOT, administers this program. So here's just one picture of a before project and an after project. This is in Benton County, four-way stop control intersection converted to a roundabout. This is just an example of the types of projects that this fund goes to help build. This map shows the history of the program. As you can see, there's several projects have been put in place implemented since 2005. This map does not include the 2017 program. I'll talk about that shortly because we just recently finished the process to collect or to award those projects. This chart kind of shows the same thing, but has added the 2017 information. Maybe the most significant thing here is prior to the 17 money that was appropriated by the legislature, the largest year previous to that was 2014 at $54.4 million. Over the history of this program, roughly $1 of state aid bond funds that have been programmed have leveraged $3 of local contributions to these projects. So the 17 legislature appropriated about $116 million into the program. Of that $116 million, there were 11 projects that were identified in statute that used $90.6 million of the funds, leaving a little over $25 million for the competitive solicitation process. The 17th solicitation resulted in 217 projects being submitted by the local agencies. Ultimately, we were able to choose and fund 36 of those projects. We use kind of a rule of thumb general approach to how we distribute the money. Approximately 35% goes to the county system. About 30% goes to the state aid cities system, 30% to small cities and townships, and then we hold back a 5% discretionary amount. And typically that 5% we use to, when we kind of draw the line for where the funding ends in each category, sometimes we end up with projects that aren't funded at the level that they've requested in their application because we've reached that 35 or 30% threshold. And so a good share of that discretionary money is then put into that last project that's on the line to meet the request that the local agency had for that project. In the categories, only projects in those categories compete against each other. So a township or small city project would not compete against the county or a larger city project. They compete against themselves and like projects. There's a $1 million cap on all requests. We do this because it helps stretch the money and we can get more projects done in more locations throughout the state. And the goal Our goal is to try to pick at least one project in every category in every district if possible so that we can distribute the money all around the state. And obviously when you have 217 projects, there's plenty of need that comes through from throughout the state. A lot of numbers here, and I won't take a lot of time to go into them, but I will just go through one line so you can understand what the words or the numbers mean. So we had a total of 217 projects. So if we look just at the state aid city category, there were 47 projects submitted in that category. Their total request for bonding was almost $42 million. That $42 million in projects, if all of them were funded, would leverage $212 million of improvements on those in those projects on those systems. Ultimately, we were able to select 10 projects in the state aid city category and fund $8.6 million towards those projects. In total, if you look at the total, 217 projects resulted in $151 million in requests that would have leveraged almost $600 million in projects. That's almost $4 for every dollar invested. And as I mentioned before, we were able to fund 36 projects to utilize the $25.2 million.
Mr. Rasmussen, just so that I understand for sure, the 584, does that include the 151, or is it added on?
Mr. Chair, that does include the 151. That's total project cost, including the grant money.
All right, thank you.
This map just shows where those 217 projects are located throughout the state that were submitted. And this map shows the location of the 36 projects that were selected. Pretty well distributed throughout the state. You'll notice that there is a little more density in the metro area, and that's primarily due to that is the location where the earmark projects, most of the earmark projects were. And it's hard to see on the map, but they're denoted with a star. And so if you just look at the projects that were programmed through the solicitation, they're pretty generally spread throughout the state. So now I'll move on into the local bridge replacement program. There are almost 16,000 bridges on the local road system, and approximately 10% of these bridges.
Excuse me, Mr. Rasmussen. Representative Dean, is your question on roads or bridges?
It's actually specifically on roads.
Then go ahead.
Now, Mr. Chair. So you gave us a lot of information about roads, and my question is there a different number when we look at actually lane miles as compared to roads?
Mr. Rasmussen. Mr. Chair.
The data that you saw on a previous slide on the total number of miles is centerline miles. If you break those out into lane miles, obviously those are larger, and it changes the math that I provided in the information.
Okay.
Representative Dean?
So if I actually go back to the slide that showed the local roads and bridge system, when you look at miles of roadway, the 92% that's in local roads, MSAS and CSAH, doesn't take into consideration, or the a lot of the trunk highway miles wouldn't take into consideration three lane or four lane or six lane or things like that as well, correct?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rasmussen.
That's correct, Representative. It takes its centerline miles.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Continue, Mr. Rasmussen.
So moving on to the bridges, as I mentioned, there about 10% of the bridges on the local system at any given time are rated structurally deficient or functionally obsolete in any given year. Each year, some of those bridges come off of that list, and others are added based on inspection reports that are required to be done. In some cases, every year, when it comes to culverts, in most cases, every 2 years. The bridge funds that this program receives are used to replace or rehabilitate bridges on the local system. Each agency prioritizes the bridges on their system by looking at the sufficiency rating and their eligibility for funding. And then at the county level, they pass a board resolution
providing the priority list of their bridges that are eligible for funding and in the order that they would like to see them funded. Those priority lists are forwarded to the Office of State Aid. We take those lists and compile them into one large list that we use to identify the need that's on the system. Just like LRIP funds, the bridge funds can only be used for bridge construction. As with any bridge project, you have approach grading, you have to remove the old bridge, you have engineering and right-of-way needs oftentimes for the project. All of those costs are borne by the local agency. The bridge replacement funds are only used for replacing the structure that's there. Here I added one picture of a before bridge and an after bridge. I used to be a county engineer before I took this position, and I can assure you there's plenty of bridges out there that still look like the one on the left side. This map shows the history of the bridge replacement program. It's been in place longer than the local road improvement program. And some data around the number of bridges, the average bridge costs. In 2017, the legislature provided a little over $49 million for the program. After funding the earmarked projects, there was about $16 million left over to program projects. As of today, all of that money has been programmed into projects, and there's no money left to do any additional projects. And historically, $1 of state bridge bond funds has leveraged $3 of local investments in these projects. This table shows what we have on our master bridge replacement priority list that I mentioned earlier that results in, from the board resolutions that we get. There's 620 bridges on the list for preferred replacement in 2018 and 247 on the list for 2019 and 2020. I say preferred because that's the year they would prefer to replace them, but obviously they get replaced based on the availability of the funds. The criteria for being on the list is a bridge needs to be greater than 10 foot in length, have a sufficiency rating less than 80, and be rated structurally deficient or functionally obsolete. The priority list also includes two major bridges, the historic Lift Bridge in Duluth. Their request is $11 million for treating truss corrosions, rehabilitating the lift span deck grading and sidewalk support, and other protective painting of the steel truss members. Generally, corrosion is the enemy of this bridge. The second major bridge is the Kellogg Bridge in St. Paul, and they are requesting $46 million to replace the half-mile structure, which spans I-94 and the railroad in Lower Town in St. Paul. As of today, there are 40 bridge projects with plans complete and in our office waiting for funding. These are plans where the local agencies have invested their resources in designing and developing plans, getting the approvals ready so that if money became available, these projects could go out the door relatively quickly. As I mentioned, the $16 million that we had available to program last year has already been programmed, and it's because of this waiting list where there are bridges ready to go. These projects total $64 million in requests, and some of those bridges have been on the waiting list for 3 years. The legislation in 2017 dedicated 13% of the motor vehicle sales tax to the local bridge program, and that amount is estimated to be about $12 million this year. So that $64 million request still has a gap of $52 million just for the projects that are on the way, sitting in our office waiting ready to go. So this is a list of the bridges on the waiting list, not the priority list, but the waiting list, bridges that are ready to go in their location in the state. And with that, I can stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rasmussen. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was sorry to see Mr. Lee leave because I was going to address my question to him, but I'll I'll lay it out anyway and see if someone else can. At one point, he discussed with us local road and bridge, and my memory is that he said something about in that transportation bill just recently passed, that funding bill, that we had, in fact, established a way to do all local bridges.
Mr. Rasmussen?
That was the intention.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, I believe maybe what he was referring to was the last point that I just made where 13% of the leased vehicle sales tax revenue was dedicated to local bridges, and that's the first time that that has had that this program has had that dedication. But as I mentioned, that will result in we're estimating $12 million this year. So certainly a terrific opportunity where we have dedicated funding to this program where we can at least be assured and communicate with our local partners that they can continue to get bridges ready, and we'll get those bridges funded through that amount of money. But it still falls well short of funding all of the bridges that are on the priority list.
Any other questions? Representative South.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Page 15, the chart there evades me. I must have, nodded off and fell asleep. No, I did not. But somehow I missed the explanation. Because you got 2018 and then a number, and 2019, 20, and then a number, and then the word biennium, and I don't understand how that fits in relationship to the other words.
Mr. Rasmussen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the biennium need is the total of those two groups together. They've just been broken out based on when the local agency prefers or says they can be ready to deliver these projects.
Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no other business to come before us today, we meet again next Tuesday. Well, King, this case is closed.